Chapter 129. "It is some of Sedley's wine," whispered the butler to his master. "I've had it a long time, and paid a good figure for it too," Mr. Osborne said aloud to his guest, and then whispered to his right-hand neighbor how he had got it. "The old chap's sale." More than once he asked the major about Mrs. George Osborne, a theme on which the major could be very eloquent when he chose. He told Mr. Osborne of her sufferings, of her passionate attachment to her husband, whose memory she worshipped still, of the tender and dutiful manner in which he had supported her parents and given up her boy when it seemed to her duty to do so. "You don't know what she endured, sir," said honest Dobbin with a tremor in his voice, "and I hope and trust you will be reconciled to her. If she took your son away from you, she gave hers to you. And however much you loved dear George, depend on it, she loved hers 10 times more." "By God, you are a good feller, sir," was all Mr. Osborne said. It had never struck him that the widow would feel any pain at parting from the boy, or that his having a fine fortune could grieve her. A reconciliation was announced as speedy and inevitable, and Amelia's heart already began to beat at the notion of the awful meeting with George's father. It was never, however, destined to take place. Old Sedley's lingering illness and death supervened, after which a meeting was for some time impossible. That catastrophe and other events may have worked upon Mr. Osborne. He was much shaken of late, and aged, and his mind was working inwardly. He had sent for his lawyers, and probably changed something in his will. The medical man who looked in pronounced him shaky, agitated, and talked of a little blood and the seaside, but he took neither of these remedies. One day when he should have come down to breakfast, his servant, missing him, went into his dressing room and found him lying at the foot of the dressing table in a fit. Miss Osborne was apprised. The doctors were sent for. Georgie stopped away from school. The bleeders and cuppers came. Osborne partially regained cognizance, but never could speak again, though he tried dreadfully once or twice, and in 4 days he died. The doctors went down, and the undertaker's men went up the stairs, and all the shutters were shut towards the garden in Russell Square. Bullock rushed from the city in a hurry. How much money had he left to that boy? Not half, surely? Surely share and share alike between the three? It was an agitating moment. What was it that poor old man tried once or twice in vain to say? I hope it was that he wanted to see Amelia and be reconciled before he left the world to one dear and faithful wife of his son. It was most likely that, for his will showed that the hatred which he had so long cherished had gone out of his heart. They found in the pocket of his dressing gown the letter with the great red seal which George had written him from Waterloo. He had looked at the other papers too, relative to his son, for the key of the box in which he kept them was also in his pocket, and it was found the seals and envelopes had been broken very likely on the night before the seizure, when the butler had taken him tea into his study, and found him reading in the great red family Bible. When the will was opened, it was found that half the property was left to George, and the remainder between the two sisters. Mr. Bullock to continue, for their joint benefit, the affairs of the commercial house, or to go out, as he thought fit. An annuity of £500, chargeable on George's property, was left to his mother, the widow of my beloved son, George Osborne, who was to resume the guardianship of the boy. Major William Dobbin, my beloved son's friend, was appointed executor, and as out of his kindness and bounty, and with his own private funds, he maintained my grandson and my son's widow, when they were otherwise without means of support, the testator went on to say, hereby thank him heartily for his love and regard for them, and beseech him to accept such a sum as may be sufficient to purchase his commission as a lieutenant colonel, or to be disposed of in any way he may think fit. When Amelia heard that her father-in-law was reconciled to her, her heart melted, and she was grateful for the fortune left to her. but when she heard how Georgie was restored to her, and knew how and by whom, and how it was William's bounty that supported her in poverty, how it was William who gave her her husband and her son, oh, then she sank on her knees, and prayed for blessings on that constant and kind heart. She bowed down and humbled herself, and kissed the feet, as it were, of that beautiful and generous affection. And gratitude was all that S.E. had to pay back for such admirable devotion and benefits, only gratitude. If she thought of any other return, the image of George stood up out of the grave and said, "You are mine, and mine only, now, and forever." William knew her feelings. Had he not passed his whole life in divining them? When the nature of Mr. Osborne's will became known to the world, it was edifying to remark how Mrs. George Osborne rose in the estimation of the people forming her circle of acquaintance. The servants of Joe's establishment, who used to question her humble orders, and say they would ask master whether or not they could obey, never thought now of that sort of appeal. The cook forgot to sneer at her shabby old gowns, which, indeed, were quite eclipsed by that lady's finery, when she was dressed to go to church of a Sunday evening. The others no longer grumbled at the sound of her bell, or delayed to answer that summons. The coachman, who grumbled that his osses should be brought out, and his carriage made into an hospital for that old feller and Mrs. O, drove her with the utmost alacrity now, and trembling lest he should be superseded by Mr. Osborne's coachman, asked at them their Russell Square coachman knew about town, and whether they was fit to sit on a box before a lady? Joe's friends, male and female, suddenly became interested about Emmy, and cards of condolence multiplied on her hall table. Joe's himself, who had looked on her as a good-natured harmless pauper, to whom it was his duty to give victuals and shelter, paid her and the rich little boy, his nephew, the greatest respect, was anxious that she should have change and amusement after her troubles and trials, poor dear girl, and began to appear at the breakfast table, and most particularly to ask how she would like to dispose of the day. In her capacity of guardian to Georgie, she, with the consent of the major, her fellow trustee, begged Miss Osborne to live in the Russell Square house, as long as ever she chose to dwell there. But that lady, with thanks, declared that she never could think of remaining alone in that melancholy mansion, and departed in deep mourning to Cheltenham, with a couple of her old domestics. The rest were liberally paid and dismissed, the faithful old butler, whom Mrs. Osborne proposed to retain, resigning and preferring to invest his savings in a public house, where, let us hope, he was not unprosperous. Miss Osborne not choosing to live in Russell Square, Mrs. Osborne also, after consultation, declined to occupy the gloomy old mansion there. The house was dismantled. The rich furniture and effects, the awful chandeliers and dreary blank mirrors packed away and hidden, the rich rosewood drawing room suite was muffled in straw, the carpets were rolled up and corded, the small select library of well-bound books was stowed in two wine chests, and the whole paraphernalia rolled away in several enormous vans to the Pantechnicon, where they were to lie until Georgie's majority. And the great heavy dark plate chests went off to Messrs. Stumpy and Rowdy, to lie in the cellars of those eminent bankers until the same period should arrive. One day Emmy, with George in her hand and clad in deep sables, went to visit the deserted mansion which S.E. had not entered since she was a girl. The place in front was littered with straw, where the vans had been laden and rolled off. They went into the great blank rooms, the walls of which bore the marks where the pictures and mirrors had hung. Then they went up the great blank stone staircases into the upper rooms, into that where Grandpapa died, as George said in a whisper, and then higher still into George's own room. The boy was still clinging by her side, but she thought of another besides him. She knew that it had been his father's room as well as his own. She went up to one of the open windows, one of those at which she used to gaze with a sick heart when the child was first taken from her, and thence as she looked out she could see, over the trees of Russell Square, the old house in which she herself was born, and where S.E. had passed so many happy days of sacred youth. They all came back to her, the pleasant holidays, the kind faces, the careless, joyful pastimes, and the long pains and trials that had since cast her down. She thought of these, and of the man who had been her constant protector, her good genius, her sole benefactor, her tender and generous friend. "Look here, mother," said Georgie, "here's a G-O-O scratched on the glass with a diamond. I never saw it before, I never did it. It was your father's room long before you were born, George," she said, and she blushed as she kissed the boy. She was very silent as they drove back to Richmond, where they had taken a temporary house, where the smiling lawyers used to come bustling over to see her,
and we may be sure noted the visit in the bill, colon,
and where of course there was a room for Major Dobbin too, who rode over frequently, having much business to transact on behalf of his little ward. Georgie at this time was removed from Mr. Veal's on an unlimited holiday, and that gentleman was engaged to prepare an inscription for a fine marble slab, to be placed up in the foundling under the monument of Captain George Osborne. The female bullock, aunt of Georgie, although despoiled by that little monster of one half of the sum which she expected from her father, nevertheless showed her charitableness of spirit by being reconciled to the mother and the boy. Rehampton is not far from Richmond, and one day the chariot, with the golden bullocks emblazoned on the panels, and the flaxen children within, drove to Amelia's house at Richmond, and the Bullock family made an eruption into the garden, where Amelia was reading a book, Joe's was in Ann Arbor placidly dipping strawberries into wine, and the Major in one of his Indian jackets was giving a back to Georgie, who chose to jump over him. He went over his head and bounded into the little advance of Bullocks, with immense black bows in their hats, and huge black sashes, accompanying their mourning mama. He is just of the age for Rosa, the fond parent thought, and glanced towards that dear child, an unwholesome little miss of 7 years of age. "Rosa, go and kiss your dear cousin," Mrs. Frederick said.
"Aunt, you know me, George? I am your aunt.
I know you well enough," George said, "but I don't like kissing, please," and he retreated from the obedient caresses of his cousin.
"Take me to your dear mama, you droll child," Mrs. Frederick said, and those ladies accordingly met, after an absence of more than 15 years. During Emmy's cares and poverty the other had never once thought about coming to see her, but now that she was decently prosperous in the world, her sister-in-law came to her as a matter of course. So did numbers more. Our old friend, Miss Swartz, and her husband came thundering over from Hampton Court, with flaming yellow liveries, and was as impetuously fond of Amelia as ever. Miss Swartz would have liked her always, if she could have seen her. One must do her that justice. But, cave all his vows? In this vast town one has not the time, to go and seek one's friends. If they drop out of the rank they disappear, and we march on without them. Who is ever missed in Vanity Fair? But so, in a word, and before the period of grief for Mr. Osborne's death had subsided, Emmy found herself in the center of a very genteel circle indeed, the members of which could not conceive that anybody belonging to it was not very lucky. There was scarce one of the ladies that hadn't a relation a peer, though the husband might be a drysalter in the city. Some of the ladies were very blue and well-informed, reading Mrs. Somerville, and frequenting the Royal Institution. Others were severe and evangelical, and held by Exeter Hall. Emmy, it must be owned, found herself entirely at a loss in the midst of their clavers, and suffered woefully on the one or two occasions on which she was compelled to accept Mrs. Frederick Bullock's hospitalities. That lady persisted in patronizing her, and determined most graciously to form her. She found Amelia's milliners for her, and regulated her household and her manners. She drove over constantly from Rehampton, and entertained her friend with faint fashionable fiddle-faddle and feeble court slip-slop. Joe's liked to hear it, but the Major used to go off growling at the appearance of this woman, with her twopenny gentility.
He went to sleep under Frederick Bullock's bald head. After dinner, at one of the banker's best parties, Fred was still anxious that the balance of the Osborne property should be transferred from Stumpy and Rowdy's to them. And whilst Amelia, who did not know Latin, or who wrote the last crack article in the Edinburgh, and did not in the least deplore, or otherwise, Mr. Peel's late extraordinary tergiversation on the fatal Catholic relief bill, sat dumb amongst the ladies, in the grand drawing room, looking out upon velvet lawns, trim gravel walks, and glistening hot houses. "She seems good-natured but insipid," said Mrs. Rowdy. "That major seems to be particularly epris." "She wants done sadly," said Mrs. Hollyock. "Why, dear creature, you never will be able to form her." "She is dreadfully ignorant or indifferent," said Mrs. Glory with a voice, as if from the grave, and a sad shake of the head and turban. "I asked her if she thought that it was in 1836 according to Mr. Jowles, or in 1839 according to Mr. Wapshot, that the Pope was to fall. And she said, 'Poor Pope! I hope not. What has he done?'" "She is my brother's widow, my dear friends," Mrs. Frederick replied, "and as such I think we're all bound to give her every attention and instruction on entering into the world. You may fancy there can be no mercenary motives in those whose disappointments are well known." "That poor dear Mrs. Bullock," said Rowdy to Hollyock, as they drove away together, "he is always scheming and managing. She wants Mrs. Osborne's account to be taken from our house to hers, and the way in which she coaxes that boy, and makes him sit by that blear-eyed little Rosa is perfectly ridiculous. I wish Glory was choked with her Man of Sin and her Battle of Armageddon," cried the other, and the carriage rolled away over Putney Bridge. But this sort of society was too cruelly genteel for Emmy, and all jumped for joy when a foreign tour was proposed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.